A fine morning, sire. I trust you slept well.
Tepic waved a hand at Dios, but said nothing. The barber was working through the ceremony of going forth shaven. The barber was trembling. Until recently, he had been a one-handed, unemployed stonemason. Then the terrible high priest had summoned him and ordered him to be the king's barber. But it meant you had to touch the king. But it was all right, because it was all sorted out by the priests, and nothing more had to be chopped off. On the whole, it was better than he had thought, and a great honour to be single-handedly responsible for the king's beard, such as it was.
"You were not disturbed in any way?" said the high priest.
His eyes scanned the room on a raster of suspicion. It was surprising that little lines of molten rock didn't drip off the walls.
"If you would but hold still, O never-dying one," said the barber, in the pleading tone of voice employed by one who is assured of a guided tour of a crocodile's alimentary tract if he nicks an ear.
"You heard no strange noises, sire?" said Dios.
He stepped back suddenly so that he could see behind the gilded peacock screen at the other end of the room.
"No." "Your Majesty looks a little peaky this morning, sire," said Dios.
He sat down on the bench with the carved cheetahs on either end. Sitting down in the presence of the king, except on ceremonial occasions, was not something that was allowed. It did, however, mean that he could squint under Tepic's low bed. Dios was rattled. Despite the aches and the lack of sleep, Tepic felt oddly elated. He wiped his chin.
"It's the bed," he said. "I think I have mentioned it. Mattresses, you know. They have feathers in them. If the concept is unfamiliar, ask the pirates of Kali. Half of them must be sleeping on goose-feather mattresses by now."
"His Majesty is pleased to joke," said Dios.
Tepic knew he shouldn't push it any further, but he did so anyway.
"Something wrong, Dios?" he said.
"A miscreant broke into the palace last night. The girl Petrachi is missing."
"That is very disturbing."
"Yes, sire.
Probably a suitor, or a swain, or something."
Dios's face was like stone.
"Possibly, sire."
"The sacred crocodiles will be going hungry, then."
But not for long, Tepic thought. Walk to the end of any of the little jetties down by the bank, let your shadow fall on the river, and the mud-yellow water would become, by magic, mud-yellow bodies. They looked like large, sodden logs, the main difference being that logs don't open at one end and bite your legs off. The sacred crocodiles of the Dajel were the kingdom's garbage disposal, river patrol, and occasional morgue. They couldn't simply be called big. If one of the huge bulls ever drifted sideways onto the current, he'd dam the river. The barber tiptoed out. A couple of body servants tiptoed in.
"I anticipated Your Majesty's natural reaction, sire," Dios continued, "like the drip of water in deep limestone caverns."
"Jolly good," said Tepic, inspecting the clothes for the day. "What was it exactly?"
"A detailed search of the palace, room by room."
"Absolutely. Carry on, Dios."
"My face is perfectly open," he told himself. "I haven't twitched a muscle out of place. I know I haven't. He can read me like a steel. I can outstare him."
Thank you, sire."
"I imagine they'll be miles away by now," said Tepic, "whoever they were. She was only a handmaiden, wasn't she?"
"It is unthinkable that anyone could disobey your judgments. There is no one in the kingdom that would dare to. Their souls would be forfeit. They will be hunted down, sir. Hunted down and destroyed."
The servants cowered behind Tepic. This wasn't mere anger. This was wrath. Real old-time vintage wrath. And waxing? It waxed like a hatful of moons.
"Are you feeling all right, Dios?"
Dios had turned to look out across the river. The Great Pyramid was almost complete. The sight of it seemed to calm him down, or at least stabilize him on some new mental plateau.
Yes, sire, he said. Thank you. He breathed deeply. Tomorrow, sire, you are pleased to witness the capping of the pyramid. A momentous occasion. Of course, it will be some time before the interior chambers are completed.
Fine. Fine, and this morning I think I should like to visit my father.
I am sure the late king will be pleased to see you, sire. It is your wish,
that I should accompany you. Oh. It's a fact as immutable as the third law of Sod that there is no such thing as a good Grand Vizier. A predilection to cackle and plot is apparently part of the job spec. High priests tend to get put in the same category. They have to face the implied assumption that no sooner do they get the funny hat than they're issuing strange orders, e.g. princesses tied to rocks for itinerant sea monsters and throwing little babies in the sea. This is a gross slander. Throughout the history of the disc, most high priests have been serious, pious, and conscientious men who have done their best to interpret the wishes of the gods, sometimes disemboweling or flaying alive hundreds of people in a day in order to make sure they're getting it absolutely right. King Tepikaimon the 27th's casket lay in state. Crafted it was of Forifi, Smaragdgin, Skelsa, and Delphinet. Inlaid it was with pink jade and shode, perfumed and fumed it was, with many rare resins and perfumes. It looked very impressive, but, the king considered, it wasn't worth dying for. He gave up and wandered across the courtyard. A new player had entered the drama of his death. Gringer, the maker of models. He'd always wondered about the models. Even a humble farmer expected to be buried with a selection of crafted livestock, which would somehow become real in the netherworld. Many a man made do with one cow like a toast rack in this world in order to afford a pedigree herd in the next. Nobles and kings got the complete set, including model carts, houses, boats, and anything else too big or inconvenient to fit in the tomb. Once on the other side, they'd somehow become the genuine article. The king frowned. When he was alive, he'd known that it was true, not doubted it for a moment. Gringer stuck his tongue out of the corner of his mouth as with great care he tweezed a tiny oar to a perfect 1/80th scale river trireme. Every flat surface in his corner of the workshop was stacked with midget animals and artifacts. Some of his more impressive ones hung from wires on the ceiling. The king had already ascertained from overheard conversation that Gringer was 26, couldn't find anything to stop the inexorable advance of his acne, and lived at home with his mother, where, in the evenings, he made models. Deep in the duffel coat of his mind, he hoped one day to find a nice girl who would understand the absolute importance of getting every detail right on a ceremonial six-wheeled ox cart, and who would hold his glue pot and always be ready with a willing thumb whenever anything needed firm pressure until the paste dried. He was aware of trumpets and general excitement behind him. He ignored it. There always seemed to be a lot of fuss these days. In his experience, it was always about trivial things. People just didn't have their priorities right. He'd been waiting 2 months for a few ounces of gum varnetti, and it didn't seem to bother anyone. He screwed his eyeglass into a more comfortable position and slotted a minute steering oar into place. Someone was standing next to him. Well, they could make themselves useful.
Could you just put your finger here, he said, without glancing around. Just for a minute, until the glue sets.
There seemed to be a sudden drop in temperature. He looked up into a smiling, golden mask. Over its shoulder, Dios's face was shading, in Gringer's expert opinion, from number 13, pale flesh, to number 37, sunset purple, gloss.
Oh, he said. It's very good, said Tepic. What is it?
Gringer blinked at him. Then he blinked at the boat.
It's an 80-foot Carly-fashioned river trireme with fishtail spear deck and ramming prow, he said automatically.
He got the impression that more was expected of him. He cast around for something suitable.
It's got more than 500 bits, he added. Every plank on the deck is individually cut. Look.
Fascinating, said Tepic. Well, I won't hold you up. Carry on the good work.
The sail really unfurls, said Gringer. See, if you pull this thread, the
mask had moved. Dios was there instead. He gave Gringer a short glare, which indicated that more would be heard about this later on, and hurried after the king. So did the ghost of Tepikaimon the 27th. Tepik's eyes swiveled behind the mask. There was the open doorway into the room of caskets. He could just make out the one containing Petrachi. The wedge of wood was still under the lid.
Our father, however, is over here, sire, said Dios.
He could move as silently as a ghost.
Oh, yes.
Tepic hesitated and then crossed to the big case on its trestles. He stared down at it for some time. The gilded face on the lid looked like every other mask.
"A very good likeness, sire," prompted Dios.
"Yes," said Tepic, "I suppose so. He definitely looks happier, I suppose."
"Hallo, my boy," said the king.
He knew that no one could hear him, but he felt happier talking to them all the same. It was better than talking to himself. He was going to have more than enough time for that.
"I think it brings out the best in him, O Commander of the Heavens," said the head sculptor.
"Makes me look like a constipated wax dolly."
Tepic cocked his head on one side.
"Yes,"
he said uncertainly.
"Yes. Well done."
He half turned to look through the doorway again. Dios nodded to the guards on either side of the passageway.
"If you will excuse me, sire,"
he said urbanely.
"Hmm?"
"The guards will continue their search."
Right. Oh."
Dios bore down on Patrache's casket, flanked by guards. He gripped the lid, thrust it backwards, and said,
"Behold, what do we find?"
Dil and Gurn joined him. They looked inside.
"Wood shavings," said Dil.
Gurn sniffed.
"They smell nice, though," he said.
Dios's fingers drummed on the lid. Tepic had never seen him at a loss before. The man actually started tapping the sides of the case, apparently seeking any hidden panels. He closed the lid carefully and looked blankly at Tepic, who for the first time was very glad that the mask didn't reveal his expression.
"She's not in there," said the old king. "She got out for a call of nature when the men went to have their breakfast."
"She must have climbed out," Tepic told himself. "So where is she now?" Dios scanned the room carefully, and then after swinging slowly backwards and forwards like a compass needle, his eyes fixed on the king's mummy case. It was big. It was roomy. There was a certain inevitability about it. He crossed the room in a couple of strides and heaved it open.
"Don't bother to knock," the king grumbled. "It's not as if I'm going anywhere."
Tepic risked a look. The mummy of the king was quite alone.
"Are you sure you're feeling all right, Dios?" he said.
"Yes, sire. We cannot be too careful, sire. Certainly they are not here, sire."
"You look as if you could do with a breath of fresh air," said Tepic, upbraiding himself for doing this, but doing it nevertheless.
Dios, at a loss, was an awe-inspiring sight, and slightly disconcerting. It made one instinctively fear for the stability of things.
"Yes, sire. Thank you, sire."
"Have a sit down and someone will bring you a glass of water, and then we will go and inspect the pyramid."
Dios sat down. There was a terrible little splintering noise.
"He sat on the boat," said the king. "First humorous thing I've seen him do."
The pyramid gave a new meaning to the word massive. It bent the landscape around it. It seemed to Tepic that its very weight was deforming the shape of things, stretching the kingdom like a lead ball on a rubber sheet. He knew that was a ridiculous idea. Big though the pyramid was, it was tiny compared to, say, a mountain. But big, very big, compared with anything else. Anyway, mountains were meant to be big. The fabric of the universe was used to the idea. The pyramid was a made thing, and much bigger than a made thing ought to be. It was also very cold. The black marble of its sides was shining white with frost in the roasting afternoon sun. He was foolish enough to touch it, and left a layer of skin on the surface.
"It's freezing!"
"It's storing already, oh breath of the river," said Pataclusp, who was sweating. "It's the boundary effect." "I note that you have ceased work on the burial chambers," said Dios. "The men, the temperature boundary effect, a bit too much to risk," muttered Pataclusp.
Tepic looked from one to the other. "What's the matter?" he said. "Are there problems?"
Said Pataclusp.
"You're way ahead of schedule. Marvellous work," said Tepic. "You put a tremendous amount of labour on the job."
Yes, only...
There was a silence, except for the distant sounds of men at work and the faint noise of the air sizzling where it touched the pyramid. It's bound to be all right when we get the capstone on, the pyramid builder managed eventually. Once it's flaring properly, no problem. He indicated the electrum capstone. It was surprisingly small, only a foot or so across, and rested on a couple of trestles. We should be able to put it on tomorrow, said Patterclusp. Would your sire still be honouring us with the capping out ceremony? In his nervousness, he gripped the hem of his robe and began to twist it. There's drinks, he stuttered, and a silver trowel that you can take away with you. Everyone shouts hurrah and throws their hats in the air.
Certainly, said Dios, it will be an honour.
And for us too, your sire, said Patterclusp loyally. I meant for you, said the High Priest. He turned to the wide courtyard between the base of the pyramid and the river, which was lined with statues and stelae commemorating King Tepikaimon's mighty deeds, and pointed. The carvers had to use quite a lot of imagination. The late king had had many fine attributes, but doing mighty deeds wasn't among them. The score was, number of enemies ground as dust under his chariot wheels, zero. Number of thrones crushed beneath his sandaled feet, zero. Number of times world bestrode like Colossus, zero. On the other hand, reigns of terror, zero. Number of times own throne crushed beneath enemy sandals, zero. Faces of poor ground, zero. Expensive crusades embarked upon, zero. His life had basically been a no-score win.
And you can get rid of that, he added.
Patterclusp gave him a look of unhappy innocence.
That statue, said Dias, is what I am referring to.
Well, we thought once you saw it in place, you see, in the right light, and what with the hat and the vulture-headed god being very,
It goes, said Dias.
Right you are, your reverence, said Patterclusp, miserably.
It was, right now, the least of his problems, but on top of everything else, he was beginning to think that the statue was following him around. Dios leaned closer.
You haven't seen a young woman anywhere on the site, have you? He demanded.
No women on the site, my lord, said Patterclusp. Very bad luck.
This one was provocatively dressed, the High Priest said.
No women.
The palace is not far, you see. There must be many places to hide over here,
Dios continued insistently. Patterclusp swallowed. He knew that all right. Whatever had possessed him.
I assure you, your reverence, he said.
Dios gave him a scowl and then turned to where Tepic, as it turned out, had been.
Please ask him not to shake hands with anybody, said the builder, as Dios hurried after the distant glint of sunlight on the gold.
The king still didn't seem to be able to get alongside the idea that the last thing people wanted was a man of the people. Those workers who couldn't get out of the way in time were thrusting their hands behind their back. Alone now, Patterclusp fanned himself and staggered into the shade of his tent, where, waiting to see him, were Patterclusp 2A, Patterclusp 2A, Patterclusp 2A, and Patterclusp 2A. Patterclusp always felt uneasy in the presence of accountants, and four of them together was very bad, especially when they were all the same person. Three Patterclusp 2Bs were there as well. The other two, unless it was three by now, were out on the site. He waved his hands in a conciliatory way.
All right, he said. What are today's problems?
One of the 2As pulled a stack of wax tablets towards him.
Have you any idea, father, he began, employing that thin, razor-edged voice that accountants use to preface something unexpected and very expensive, what calculus is?
You tell me, said Patterclusp, sagging onto a stool.
It's what I've had to invent to deal with the wages bill, father, said another 2A.
I thought that was algebra, said Patterclusp.
We passed algebra last week, said a third 2A. It's calculus now. I've had to loop myself another four times to work on it, and there's three of me working on,
he glanced at his brothers,
quantum accountancy.
What's that for? Said his father wearily.
Next week, the leading accountant glared at the top slab, for example, he said, you know Retour, the fresco painter?
What about him?
He, that is, they, have put in a bill for 2 years' work.
Oh,
they say they did it on Tuesday, on account of how time is fractal in nature, they said.
They said that?
said Pataclusp. "It's amazing what they pick up," said one of the accountants, glaring at the paracosmic architects. Pataclusp hesitated.
"How many of them are there?"
"How should we know? We know there were 53. Then he went critical. We've certainly seen him round a lot." Two of the 2As sat back and steepled their fingers, always a bad sign in anyone having anything to do with money. "The problem is," one of them continued, "that after the initial enthusiasm, a lot of the workers looped themselves unofficially so that they could stay at home and send themselves out to work."
"But that's ridiculous," Pataclusp protested weakly. "They're not different people, they're just doing it to themselves."
"That's never stopped anyone, Father," said 2A. "How many men have stopped drinking themselves stupid at the age of 20 to save a stranger dying of liver failure at 40?
There was silence while they tried to work this one out.
"A stranger?" said Pataclusp uncertainly. "I mean himself when older," snapped 2A. "That was philosophy," he added.
"One of the masons beat himself up yesterday," said one of the 2Bs gloomily. "He was fighting with himself over his wife. Now he's going mad because he doesn't know whether it's an earlier version of him or someone he hasn't been yet. He's afraid he's going to creep up on him." "It's worse than that too, Dad. We're paying 40,000 people and we're only employing 2,000.
"It's going to bankrupt us. That's what you're going to say," said Pataclusp. "I know. It's all my fault. I just wanted something to hand on to you, you know. I didn't expect all this. It seemed too easy to start with."
One of the 2As cleared his throat.
"It's, not quite as bad as all that," he said quietly.
"What do you mean?" The accountant laid a dozen copper coins on the table.
"Well, he said, "you see, it occurred to me, since there's all this movement in time, that it's not just people who can be looped. And, look, you see these coins?"
One coin vanished.
"They're all the same coin, aren't they?" said one of his brothers.
"Well, yes," said the 2A, very embarrassed, because interfering with the divine flow of money was alien to his personal religion.
"The same coin at 5-minute intervals."
"And you're using this trick to pay the men?" said Pataclusp dully.
"It's not a trick. I gave them the money," said 2A primly. "What happens to it afterwards isn't my responsibility, is it?"
"I don't like any of this," said his father.
"Don't worry, it all evens out in the end," said one of the 2As. "Everyone gets what's coming to them."
"Yes, that's what I'm afraid of," said Pataclusp.
It's just a way of letting your money work for you," said another son. It's probably quantum."
"Oh, good," said Pataclusp weakly.
"We'll get the block on tonight. Don't worry," said one of the 2Bs. "After it's flared the power off, we can all settle down."
"I told the king we'd do it tomorrow."
The Pataclusp 2Bs went pale in unison. Despite the heat, it suddenly seemed a lot colder in the tent.
"Tonight, father," said one of them.
"Surely you mean tonight."
"Tomorrow," said Pataclusp firmly. "I've arranged an awning and people throwing lotus blossom. There's going to be a band. Toxins and trumpets and tinkling cymbals and speeches and a meat tea afterwards. That's the way we've always done it. Attracts new customers. They like to have a look around."
"Father, you've seen the way it soaks up. You've seen the frost."
"Let it soak. We Pataclusps don't go around capping off pyramids as though we were finishing off a garden wall. We don't knock off like a what's-name in the night. People expect a ceremony."
"But I'm not listening. I've listened to too much of this newfangled stuff. Tomorrow. I've had the bronze plaque made, and the velvet curtains and everything."
One of the 2As shrugged.
"It's no good arguing with him," he said. "I'm from 3 hours ahead. I remember this meeting. We couldn't change his mind."
"I'm from 2 hours ahead," said one of his clones. "I remember you saying that, too."
Beyond the walls of the tent, the pyramid sizzled with accumulated time. There is nothing mystical about the power of pyramids. Pyramids are dams in the stream of time. Correctly shaped and orientated, with the proper paracosmic measurements correctly plumbed in, the temporal potential of the great mass of stone can be diverted to accelerate or reverse time over a very small area
in the same way that a hydraulic ram can be induced to pump water against the flow. The original builders, who were of course ancients, and therefore wise, knew this very well, and the whole point of a correctly built pyramid was to achieve absolute null time in the central chamber, so that a dying king tucked up there would indeed live forever, or at least never actually die. The time that should have passed in the chamber was stored in the bulk of the pyramid and allowed to flare off once every 24 hours. After a few eons, people forgot this and thought you could achieve the same effect by A. ritual, B. pickling people, and C. storing their soft inner bits in jars. This seldom works. And so the art of pyramid tuning was lost, and all the knowledge became a handful of misunderstood rules and hazy recollections. The ancients were far too wise to build very big pyramids. They could cause very strange things, things that would make mere fluctuations in time look tiny by comparison. By the way, contrary to popular opinion, pyramids don't sharpen razor blades, they just take them back to when they weren't blunt. It's probably because of quantum. Tepic lay on the strata of his bed, listening intently. There were two guards outside the door, and another two on the balcony outside, and, he was impressed at Dios's forethought, one on the roof. He could hear them trying to make no noise. He'd hardly been able to protest. If black-clad miscreants were getting into the palace, then the person of the king had to be protected. It was undeniable. He slipped off the solid mattress and glided through the twilight to the statue of Bast, the cat-headed god, in the corner, twisted off the head, and pulled out his assassin's costume. He dressed quickly, cursing the lack of mirrors, and then padded across and lurked behind a pillar. The only problem, as far as he could see, was not laughing. Being a soldier in Djeli Baby was not a high-risk job. There was never a hint of internal rebellion, and since either neighbour could crush the kingdom instantly by force of arms, there was no real point in selecting keen and belligerent warriors. In fact, the last thing the priesthood wanted was enthusiastic soldiers. Enthusiastic soldiers with no fighting to do soon got bored and started thinking dangerous thoughts like how much better they could run the country. Instead, the job attracted big, solid men, the kind of men who could stand stock still for hours at a time without getting bored, men with the build of an ox and the mental processes to match. Excellent bladder control was also desirable. He stepped out onto the balcony. Tepic had learned how not to move stealthily. Millions of years of being eaten by creatures that know how to move stealthily has made humanity very good at spotting stealthy movement. Nor was it enough to make no noise, because little moving patches of silence always aroused suspicion. The trick was to glide through the night with a quiet reassurance, just like the air did. There was a guard standing just outside the room. Tepic drifted past him and climbed carefully up the wall. It had been decorated with a complex bas-relief of the triumphs of past monarchs, so Tepic used his family to give him a leg up. The breeze was blowing off the desert as he swung his legs over the parapet and walked silently across the roof, which was still hot underfoot. The air had a recently cooked smell, tinted with spice. It was a strange feeling to be creeping across the roof of your own palace, trying to avoid your own guards, engaged on a mission in direct contravention of your own decree, and knowing that if you were actually caught, you would have yourself thrown to the sacred crocodiles. After all, he'd apparently already instructed that he was to be shown no mercy if he was captured. Somehow, it added an extra thrill. There was freedom of a sort up here on the rooftops, the only kind of freedom available to a king of the valley. It occurred to Tepic that the landless peasants down on the delta had more freedom than he did. Although the seditious and non-kingly side of him said, yes, freedom to catch any diseases of their choice, starve as much as they wanted, and die of whatever dreadful ague took their fancy. But freedom of a sort. A faint noise in the huge silence of the night drew him to the riverwood edge of the roof. The Djel sprawled in the moonlight, broad and oily. There was a boat in midstream, heading back from the far bank and the necropolis. There was no mistaking the figure at the oars. The flare light gleamed off his bald head. One day, Tepic thought, I'll follow him. I'll find out what it is he does over there. If he goes over in daylight, of course. In daylight, the necropolis was merely gloomy, as though the whole universe had shut down for early closing. He'd even explored it, wandering through streets and alleys that contrived to be still and dusty no matter what the weather was on the other, the living side of the water. There was always a breathless feel about it, which was probably not to be wondered at. Assassins liked the night on general principle, but the night of the necropolis was something else. Or rather, it was the same thing, but a lot more of it. Besides, it was the only city anywhere on the disk where an assassin couldn't find employment. He reached the light well that opened on the embalmer's courtyard and peered down. A moment later, he landed lightly on the floor and slipped into the room of cases.
"Hello, lad!"
Tepic opened the lid of the case. It was still empty.
"She's in one of the ones at the back," said the king. "Never had much of a sense of direction."
It was a great big palace. Tepic could barely find his way around it by daylight. He considered his chances of carrying out a search in pitch darkness.
"It's a family trait, you know. Your granddad had to have left and right painted on his sandals. It was that bad. It's lucky for you that you take after your mother in that respect."
It was strange. She didn't talk, she chattered. She didn't seem to be able to hold a simple thought in her head for more than about 10 seconds. Her brain appeared to be wired directly to her mouth, so that as soon as a thought entered her head, she spoke it out loud. Compared to the ladies he had met at soirées in Arc, who delighted in entertaining young assassins and fed them expensive delicacies and talked to them of high and delicate matters while their eyes sparkled like carborundum drills and their lips began to glisten, compared to them, she was as empty as an empty thing. Nevertheless, he found he desperately wanted to find her. The sheer undemandingness of her was like a drug. The memory of her bosom was quite beside the point.